So this is the Spotlight on Heritage podcast with John Costa and my colleague Rob Watson. How are you, Rob? Are you okay this week?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Cool. We always start with the weather. I think we're regulars with the weather. A bit sunny today.
It's been nice. I had a lovely day yesterday. I went over to visit the castle in Nottingham. So that was nice to see a bit of art and history and heritage.
It's a fascinating place. It's had a fascinating history in its own right, and obviously recently with its closing down and then reopening again as a heritage location. I think they've done a good job to get it back open again.
Yeah, and we got a ticket that, you know, we paid for a day ticket, but then that gives us access all year, so that's quite nice. And you get that nice view when you're on the ledge, looking over the Trent Valley.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible, isn't it, that view? Funnily enough, we watched Robin Hood last night, the one with Taron Egerton from 2018, and that you really get to see Nottingham in its full castle setup. I mean, I don't know how real that is, but it was quite good to... But listen, we need to speak to someone about heritage-related subjects, and, you know, as always, we struggle to find anybody of, worth, value, stature, and then... We stumbled across, of course, Joe Roby. How are you, Joe?
And you're still looking.
And we're still looking. Yeah, still looking. So, Joe, how are you?
I'm very good. It's a bit too hot for me, unfortunately. I don't deal well with this weather.
Excellent. Not that you don't do well with the weather, but you're the first guest we've had who's had the courage to dip into the weather with us right at the beginning. So that's actually quite positive, I think. So, listen, thanks for coming in today. We've known each other for quite a while now. Obviously, your sort of day job working at the Richard III Centre and stuff, and a lot of people would probably recognise you if we were to put a photo up or the photo from this.
I'm afraid not.
And then we got in conversation about some of these characters that you play as... this is an interesting one for me. Is it reenactment? Is it cosplay? Is it, you know... bringing history alive through particular characters? And when someone said to me, What does Joe do? I said, actually, let me show you his Instagram account because it's easier with the people that you play. So I had at a party where someone go, hey, Joe does... Joe, tell him, what do you do?
There's a couple of different phrases that you use. Some people who do what I do call it living history. But that is a big thing that kind of encompasses all your things. Like, you know, when you get the big Viking encampments that people do where they've got a whole setup, almost like a village. But historical interpreter... is one
I've never
well.
Heard that one before. It's, historical interpreter.
Yeah, so just interpreting history to people in a way that's engaging and fun, but mostly in costume, which, to be blunt, is a nice chance to get paid to dress up like a kid again, which is always great.
And does a lot of your kind of the opportunities to do this thing, you know, paid work, as you said, you know, a man has to earn his cheddar, I believe the term you was as we were warming up for the podcast. Is it word of mouth? So once someone's seen you, they kind of refer you on, or people get in touch and go, oh, I've seen this, you did this at that event, could you do that for us?
It's, yeah, actually. A lot of the stuff that I've ended up doing is people telling other people that do stuff for particular like WIs or history groups around the country, just saying, I've had a talk from this chap. They talk to each other. So they'll spread it on. But people sometimes just see my social media stuff as well, some of the things that I've done as well, and just say, would you like to talk about this? And yes, I would. Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Are you kind of choosy about what you do? And I mean that in a way where not so much the people that are asking you to do it, but more about their rationale behind why they're asking you to do it. Do you think, well, actually, I'm not going to come along to that because I don't try to interpret that in that way.
Not really, no. I've never had that as an issue come up, to be honest. I think most of the time when people want me to come along, they're interested in my perspective on something rather than me interpreting it in a way that they want to. And one of the things that I do a lot with that is, like, you know, sort of dispelling myths about stuff, and people want to hear that kind of thing. They don't want to just sort of regurgitation of what might be just an incorrect fact that sounds good. So I've never actually run into an issue before like that, to be honest. Most people who want to engage it are very open to hearing different perspectives, and a lot of them have had talks from a lot of people in the past, so I don't think they get a lot of value necessarily about just doing the same thing that everybody always says, if you see what I mean. So, I've never had to turn someone down for a reason like that, to be honest. Most of the time it's because I'm busy doing something else, and unfortunately I can't make the journey, but yeah.
So, Joe, you came along to my military history live event last June. at the Leicester Adult Education Centre, wearing your samurai outfit. Mm. And I must admit, I was watching Shogun at the time on streaming, and it suddenly made me think about, you know, Military Issue Live had always been about 500 years of conflict and military history from Leicester's perspective, but actually that was the first time there was anything that was quite topical from a popular culture perspective, rather than a sort of a national or an international commemoration of something like D-Day, for example. So that's why I kind of reached out to you, and you kindly came along that day. What sort of things did people say to you, or what do they ask you about once you've given them a bit of a talk about what you're wearing and sort of, you know, the weaponry and stuff like that? What are they really fascinated about?
I'll be honest, the first question I always get when I'm wearing the samurai armor is, how heavy is it? Every single time there was, and it always surprises people how light it actually is, to be fair. But otherwise, I mean, you know, there's the general kind of disbelief that people would fight in that kind of kit, particularly because the samurai stuff is so exaggerated in a lot of ways, with the head crests and that kind of thing, and how brightly coloured it all is. But also just people have, with any kind of period of history where there's a lot of interest in it, people will have ideas of what it's supposed to be like from media in particular, and you raise Shogun as a good example of that.
Yeah, that kind of popular culture, this is how it's worn or
absolutely
used.
Yeah. And also just ideas about the culture and everything. And people want to know, is that actually true? And a lot of the time it isn't. Although Shogun as an example is actually quite a good one, because a lot of the stuff, the way that it's portrayed in that is, it's based loosely on real events, but it's an original story. But they did a really good job. And what was the name of the original author? John Clavell?
Yeah, James.
James Clavell, that's the one, yes. Clearly had read a lot about the period.
So kind of anchored it in some authenticity and
relevance.
Yeah.
And the kind of the way that it actually, Shogun surprised a lot of people because of how cutthroat the samurai actually are, for an example, which I think is good, because a lot of people have these kind of lofty ideas. I mean, a great comparison is like with the knights of Europe. Everyone has this idea of the chivalric knights, and the more you read about them, the more you realize that, oh, they were actually horrible, weren't they?
Well, yes. Not very nice people.
Yeah. It's questions like that. You get questions about, you know, how the armor was made, what it was made from, the weapons, the same thing as well. But that's one of the things that's good about when you're wearing kit like that, to talk about history. It's such a great launching off point to be able to get questions asked at you, rather than just almost preaching about the history to people. Which I think is a lot more engaging to a lot of people, rather than just being spoken at about it.
Now you've got, we worked it out, you've got roughly six characters that you engage with now. You've got your plague doctor with the really kind of long snout, which is fascinating picture to see on your Instagram account. And then the others tend to be more about sort of costumes. So I'm thinking of the samurai specifically. How committed are you to the accuracy of what you're wearing compared to the sort of costume nature of what you're doing? How much do you want it to be as accurate as possible?
I try to make it as accurate as possible in a way where that it's not going to cause me physical harm to do it.
I'm thinking of your sandals that you were wearing, particularly when you said, John, are you okay for me to kick this footwear off? Because it was actually quite painful. And of course, people don't take that into account as well.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, actually, the shoes is very often the worst thing wearing, I'll be honest, because we're so used to having these particular kind of shoes and your feet kind of match the way that they are. So suddenly having to wear just flat sandals all day whilst wearing 30 kilograms of armor, you start to feel a little bit crippled by the experience, and it can be quite unpleasant. But otherwise, you know, I try to, so like with the samurai armor, for example, it was always going to be, it's got to be proper, it's got to be done right, it's got to be real steel stuff. But that's my own personal preference. Obviously, some people would go for something that's metal-like. For me, it's I want to try and be as authentic as possible with things.
And is that a way of benchmarking yourself as someone who's serious about the subject? Because if someone came up, that, for example, who was an academic interested in that area, you'd be able to have a serious conversation with them, because you're not playing. You are in, what did you call it, historical interpretation. You're actually saying, I'm helping your deeply academic, probably slightly long-winded and boring book to come to life through what I'm wearing in a public setting around history.
I think that's definitely part of it, but there's also definitely a part of it for me where I just like doing it. Where I just enjoy wearing the proper kit, and it's just fun to talk about it and how it was made, you know.
Now, one of the things I've spoken to other reenactors about with my military history live events and stuff is I always looked upon it as, particularly the guys, say, from World War One and World War Two, where what I was after was that sort of Blue Peter meets Dorling and Kingsley meets Horrible Histories kind of vibe, which is you're there in character, a family comes up because, you know, one of them's doing World War One or World War Two at school, someone comes up and goes, you know, I'm doing this thing, I've got to write a letter from my great-grandfather to my great-grandmother. How long would it take? And for me, it was always a reenact would go, ah, here's a letter that I've got in my pocket. I've got one from my wife 3 weeks ago that took 5 weeks to get here, and I'm going to write this and she'll get it in a week's time. That's, for me, that was what it was always around, that family learning, family history around conflict, you know, the impact of people at home and away. And what I'm always interested in finding out about is, how do you pick your characters? Is it of personal interest to you, or do you think, oh, actually it's the 450th anniversary of this next year, I've got a character idea, let's see how I can pan that out and fit in with events that are coming up?
It's absolutely personal choice for me, for a couple of reasons. One is that there's a surprisingly large number of people that do similar thing to me, and from a business perspective, it'd be something where, well, why would I try to do something that this person already does and would probably do a lot better than me? And also some of it is as well is that I'm going to choose the stuff that I'm interested in because I'm inherently going to be good at doing that interpretation to people.
And spending a lot of time doing it as well. And your own money.
And money, yeah. So it's something you've got to be super interested in doing. Otherwise, it's not going to be interesting to people who are listening to you. I think... It's one of the things anyone who remembers very boring history lessons at school can tell you. If you get a teacher who isn't passionate about the subject, it can be really, really boring to learn about history. And the number of people I've spoken to who said that they're not actually particularly interested in history, but that experience of talking to me and the not to try and big myself up, but the passion that I have for it has really sort of like made them interested in a way that they wouldn't have been beforehand. So if I started doing something, say like Tudor period, which isn't something I'm particularly interested in, it wouldn't be very interesting for people listening because I'd be forcing myself to talk about it. So it's definitely something that I pick myself. And there's ideas I've got for other stuff I want to do. But again, it's always about stuff that I'm already interested in, you know?
Yeah, and then time, money, being historically accurate. And, you know, I think also with reenactors, the best are ones that I've met. I've met that are kind of slightly, you know, they look like they've stepped out of an army surplus store. And then there's others that I've met that I could name now, but that's unfair on them, that are, you know, are very, very good at what they do. And are my go-to people for a particular period in history. You realise that they take it seriously and they respect what they're doing, but also who they are representing. You know, so someone from World War One who's doing something to do with Leicestershire Regiment, the Tigers, you know, they're not playing at it and they're not disrespecting anybody that's either served or has died, you know, which again is important to me because of the At-Risk War Memorials Project. So it's always about being held to account, I think, by people coming up and going, you're trivialising the subject or you're absolutely kind of dumbing it down, yeah, type, yeah, thing. It's a level of seriousness.
There's a difficult balance to strike with it as well, because obviously you want to make it engaging, but you don't want to make it gimmicky or obnoxious in a way that disrespects the history. And it's definitely one of the advantages of doing historical interpretation for stuff that's a lot further back, so doing the samurai or Roman stuff, is that inherently you're going to be more divorced from that period of time emotionally. So it's easier to tread that line. The more modern of it you're doing, the harder it is to do that, because people might know people who are directly involved in that, so it gets very difficult. It's one of the advantages I have of predominantly doing medieval and earlier stuff, but I'd have massive respect for the guys who do the modern stuff and tread that line really, really well. You know, it's really difficult to do.
It's a fascinating subject area as well, isn't it? Because you've got these people coming up with their own versions of what it was like at that time. And I remember certainly having a conversation with people about, so, you know, documentary and docudramas with like reenactments, and people just like, well, you know, that they've interpreted that. And you go, yeah, but if there's not any photographic or film evidence of that period of time, obviously someone's diary or a series of illustrations in someone's diary is giving you an accurate thing. You're just bringing it alive.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, it's something where modern stuff is, you've got to be a lot more precise with, because you have, like you say, that photographic image of someone in the First World War, for example. And you say, well, you're wearing an 11th century Crusaders helmet whilst you're going into the trenches, so that's obviously wrong. Whereas obviously the further back you go, the less material there is, so you can extrapolate a bit more on that. Which also comes into the difficulty as well, that it can be more difficult to find stuff for that too, because it's more niche and there's less different materials that you can base it on. But yeah, it's advantages and disadvantages, I suppose.
So you're listening to Spotlight on Heritage with John Costa and Rob Watson. And we're here with Joe Roby, who is a living history specialist, historical interpretation, which I find quite interesting in your six characters. So out of your six characters, who is your favourite to be when you step into that character?
It's definitely the samurai, 110%, for multiple reasons. One, samurai history is absolutely my favourite subject to do. Two is that it just looks really, really cool. Wearing the helmet with the huge horns.
It does. Trust me, it does. Yeah, I mean, it completely changed the whole military history life.
Yeah. There's just a real presence that you have in that. And there's also, I mean, it's a similar thing with the Plague Doctor one as well. There's something about your face being covered while you're doing that, where you can kind of step into it a little bit more. You feel a little bit less vulnerable putting yourself out there with it and everything as well. And undeniably as well, when you're wearing full samurai plate armor, you do feel quite powerful. If you start to feel a little bit indestructible, which definitely helps you with that kind of the confidence to go out there and talk. But the main thing really is just that I just love samurai history. I find it so fascinating, and getting to share that with people. I just love it, honestly. If I'd won the lottery and never had to work again, I'd do it for free all the time.
Yeah. Full time.
Oh, 100%, yeah. Full-time. I'd happily do it full time.
I just want to dip into the Plague Doctor, simply because of that, you know, that image that people have of that. And Rob, you were talking earlier, wasn't you, about Norwich. You went to Norwich and did something about that, and plague pits and stuff like that. It's one of those things that is quite a strong image, isn't it? In particularly in my head, from being a child, that anything to do with the Black Death or the plague was almost like terrifying. But the characters that went with it,
I think it's because it's so far from our modern experience. You know, we've got penicillin and high tech operations. You know, the chances of death was never far away, and in you know, kind of the Tudor England and prior to that, you know, it was never present, you know, possibility. And the
and what would your life expectancy have been back then? Quite low.
Well, for a kind of ordinary peasant, probably mid to late 30s, really. So
I never knew to bit on that one, actually. Yeah. An interesting point. So that is technically true, but that is the mean average life expectancy, which is brought down dramatically by the high rates of infant mortality. So actually, if you survive to adulthood, your life expectancy might be in your 50s to 60s a lot of the time. So,
Again, it's that understanding, isn't it? The opportunity, either from an engaged teacher who's interested and passionate about that subject through to your own history.
But we still carry the, if you like, the kind of... We carry that fear with us, you know, that kind of that lack of understanding. So we think about disease still in the kind of it's sin, you know, it was sin that carried it. You know, people famously, I don't know if it's a myth, you know, it's kind of people would get rid of all the cats because they were associated with witchcraft, when it was the cats that would have dealt with the rats that were carrying the infections. And, you know, it's that kind of, you know, where do you put your trust in modern science? We live in a world where we seemingly would think that we can separate out science from mythological belief, but it's still with us. And that's why I think it's fascinating and it draws people attention, because we're still drawn to these things in terms of how we actually understand it.
I know I've had conversations before with people about the need for, you know, a heritage project or, you know, a podcast that talks about COVID from this perspective as well, about, you know, the memories of what we all did collectively when we had time or didn't have time.
Should we start a flash mob where we all reenact standing, you know, keeping 2 meters apart and wearing masks and standing in queues?
And you could just wander around with your plague doctor things on, giving out like numbers out of 10 for people's reenactment for like passing out in queues and stuff. But seriously, it's, you know, people talking about that, what we did in lockdown and what people did, you know. How long is it going to be before we have a real honest conversation about, you know, not just parties at number 10, but how things doing it before someone's reenacting someone at one of these hospitals with their PPE, you know, before it becomes a historical character interpretation of COVID.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you mention that, because it's like when I watched the excellent TV series Chernobyl, and one of my thoughts on it was, I'd really like to put together one of the liquidators outfits who did the rooftop clearance and that kind of thing, those really brave men and women who took part in that. And it turns out there are people who do that as a historical interpreter thing. And it was one of those things, the sudden realization, wait a minute, this is something that my dad and mum watched on the news.
Lived through in real time, yeah.
And just the thought of, like, you know, that we're only, what, you know, 30, 40 years separated from that. So give it a few decades and I'll be seeing, maybe we will be seeing people reenacting nurses from COVID, which would be such a bizarre feeling as someone who lived through that, you know.
So, Joe, it's very rare that we get someone comes on as a guest on our podcast that we can connect both spotlight on art and creativity with spotlight on heritage, because I think you've got a foot in both camps there with what you do and the way that you approach it. So when was the first time you can remember doing anything that was creative?
Oh my goodness.
Were you a drawer? Were you a naturally a performer dressing up?
I used to draw all the time when I was a kid, actually. Hated acting. When we did the school plays at school, absolutely despised it. I've just got
literally. So you would step away from doing that.
Oh, I
tried. Limelight and
stuff. I tried. They desperately tried to make everyone take part in the school plays, even if you were just a ghost in the background or something. But I just had just the most horrific stage fright right up until maybe about 10 years ago.
And that is fascinating, considering what you do as a hobby. I mean, kind of in your own time, you put yourself out there to do these kind of things.
It's really weird because, like I say, until about 10 years ago, even when I was at uni, given my seminar presentations are part of my coursework, I'd just be terrified about giving these talks and stuff.
So what was the turning point then?
The turning point for me, actually, bizarrely, is a combination of two things. One was working at the Space Centre. I used to work at the National Space Centre. And back in the day, when you had the planetarium shows, you had to go up in front of the audience and give like a health and safety brief.
So that was part of your job almost?
Yeah. And it terrified me. The first time I did it, I remember actually physically shaking doing it and thinking I was going to be ill, and I got through it. And then that was the first sort of build up to me being able to talk in front of a crowd. And then when I started working at the King Richard III Visitor Center, they needed someone to start doing some of the talks and presentations that we do there. And I volunteered for it, even though knowing my difficulty with talking to crowds. And that's kind of what got me building up my confidence in talking in front of groups of people. And then from there, the whole thing kicked off with History of Joe, because I was learning Japanese because of my interest in samurai history. And basically everyone kept asking me about it in the class. So I decided to start giving some free talks about it to my friends, basically.
So if we were to open another mic now to 18-year-old Joe or 16-year-old Joe sitting next to you, what was that Joe going to do when he left school?
Oh, that Joe when he left school university. was 18-year-old Joe was in a band desperately trying to get his music career off the line. And I'm not going to tell you the name of that band because nobody is going to look up that music because it is terrible. So he would
Metallica
be,
with a discount.
It was more sort of like bluesy, rocky kind of stuff, because that was my jam, but he would be hoping that would be the case. But he'd probably be quite pleased that I ended up at the very least owning a suit of samurai armor, because that was something that I've wanted to do since I was about 5.
And when can you remember, was it at uni that you kind of went through this transition of actually I want to work in the heritage sector or do something that involves, you know, public engagement like the Space Centre and then Richard III?
I think I kind of fell into it in a way because I did military history at university with no idea what, I mean, the thought of maybe becoming a teacher or carrying it further on. And then after I left university, I kind of just fell into working at the Space Centre and it all just sort of went from there, really. I just thought, well, that's going to be an interesting job working there rather than just, you know, in a shop somewhere.
And as for you, was it like working at the Space Centre because it was a job and work, or is it the fact that you got an opportunity to engage people in conversation that were clearly interested in something that you could go up and say, well, actually, this is that? Because I think for me, you know, a historical interpreter, if you like, is someone who's wanting for someone to come and speak to them so that you can actually share something with them.
100%. Because I'm one of those people who's just really interested in a lot of stuff. So I've always been interested in, like, not to a degree where I actually understand it, but astrophysics and space and all that kind of stuff, as well as dinosaurs. Who doesn't love dinosaurs? And so the chance to talk about stuff like that. And, of course, in the Space Centre, they go for a lot of stuff about the history of the space race. So it kind of blended those two things together.
Yeah, there's a bit of politics in there and everything. Yes, Cold War and the whole
absolutely
thing.
Absolutely. So I love getting to talk to people about that kind of stuff. And then moving over to the Richard III Visitor Centre was an obvious choice because it was getting to do a similar thing, but with history, which is actually my real main sort of academic passion. So, yeah.
What's the one piece of advice that you'd give yourself now if you were 18 about knowing what you do now? Is it just being open to conversations? Is it being open to putting yourself out there, willing to try different things and think about different periods of history? Don't just get stuck on, you know, I'm interested in Tudors, get stuck in that, but think about history in its broadest sense.
I think, yeah, that would
just context, isn't it? For me, it always seems to be about context.
100% would do that. And I'd also say save some more of your money because you're going to need it for more samurai stuff later.
I love that. Save your pocket money, kids. It's going to get out of control. So, Joe, thanks for coming in today on your day off and talking to us on the Spotlight on Heritage podcast. Really looking forward to people, you know, engaging with this one on Source Sound next Monday and also listening to the podcast when I send it to them, as well as I'm sure Rob will do. I mean, what I find fascinating is when you meet someone who becomes other characters in their own time, and I think about what I do for relaxing, all of that information, it's, you know, what sort of questions were you asked, you know, the other weekend when you were involved in the Roman festival on Jubilee Square? You were there in your Roman outfit representing Visit Leicester, but, you know, or the King Richard III Centre. What kind of questions were you getting asked by people?
I mean, a lot of the questions were, where's the closest toilet? But other than that...
I love that. The default question. Know where the nearest toilet is, kid. You'll be fine.
It's amazing how
people will ask you because obviously you're in costume.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But I mean, a lot of it was just the very simple question of, like, well, what is that outfit that you're wearing? Because my Roman stuff is very specifically late 3rd, early 4th century Roman, which looks very different from what people classically think of as Roman kit, you know.
And are you battling popular culture here where it's like, oh, that's not what they were wearing in Gladiator or Gladiator 1 and 2. That's not what they were wearing in Legion or whatever.
There's definitely something about that where you get it. Because a lot of people just don't... It's not a criticism of the way people see it. It's just the way that films often portray it. But there's this mindset we have that from, you know, the very first start of the Roman Republic all the way through to... Sometimes people even have this image in their head right through to the end of the Byzantine Empire in 1453, that they're still wearing that same classic Lodica segmentata, you know, the banded steel armour and all this stuff, ignoring the fact that that's like 2,000 years of technological change that's occurred through that and everything. So there's so that is something that you kind of have to get through to people a lot of the time.
So people,
as well,
people expect you to be authentically Roman from their perspective without taking into account actually the Romans would have innovated in those in that period of time.
And of course,
as well,
the empire is this huge place, so even legions in different areas would be equipped differently because it's not wasn't just a one standard kit across. It would be locally produced, a lot of the stuff that they were wearing. So there's a lot of differences between the way that different Roman soldiers would look. So yeah, this thing, I mean, I had someone who genuinely did argue with me, saying that, no, your dress is an Anglo-Saxon. I was like, I'm definitely not. I'm definitely a 3rd century Roman federati, not an Anglo-Saxon. And he's like, no, you're wrong. I'm like, okay.
I think the thing that fascinated me about the Roman Empire as well, and the more you find out about it, is that people from one side of the empire, obviously conquered people, were, if they were to serve, served on the other side of the empire, so really kind of never got a chance to pop home or even return home ever. And that's why in Britain we've got so many people that, you know, long before migration, and people get angry about it on the mainstream media or read about it in the newspaper, people from Syria and different, you know, Africa and all these kind of places, we've always been somewhere that's had people from all over the world serving here and then finding partners and putting down roots and then staying and stuff.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, we have strong records of people from North Africa being in Britain at the time. And also just the amusing thing that a lot of people don't realise, that there was a brief time where Britain, Spain, well, what is Spain now and what is France now, basically turned around to the Roman Empire and said, forget this, we're going to start our own Roman Empire, which is going to be better and more Celtic than yours. Which is something that people don't even realise about, because a lot of our kind of depiction of Roman history ends with the end of the 2nd century with Commodus, you know, and people are only interested in the kind of like the golden age of Rome. And I think it's a bit of a shame, because there's a lot of scope for learning about
integration and kind of change and evolving and stuff.
And specifically as well with sort of more local history too, because there's so much of that that just isn't covered if you don't go beyond that, the scope of that, as it were.
But well, I'm going to bring Rob in. Rob, how much of Roman Britain history, all that period that Joe's talking about there, that if we actually studied that, rather than maybe the Mary Rose or the fact that Henry VIII had 6 wives, would actually help explain modern Britain and our engagement with Europe and things like that?
There's two facts.
I know Rob would be fascinated by this.
My only two kind of main facts that I know is the Romans couldn't sail against the wind. So they had to go with the wind rather than against it. And that, I can't remember when they subsequently learned it. But after the fall of Rome, it wasn't until, I think it was the mid-18th century that any city in the world came close to the size and wealth of Rome, and that was London. And so it took over 1,500 years, basically, for it to get to that kind of scale again. So you think, you put it in that context of how big and how important Rome was.
So, Joe, finish off. What's the next character that you're going to be officially with a gig that you've got?
Officially with a gig that I've got, I know I'm going to be doing the Plague Doctor later this year, which is going to be great. I love doing my Plague Doctor stuff. But I'm hopefully going to be doing, this is going to be a new experiment that we're doing. I might be putting together a medieval monster hunter thing. So this is going a bit beyond the usual history stuff, but the idea of how would a medieval warrior in the 15th century cope with a lot of the sort of folkloric monsters that are described at the time. We're going to do this as a Halloween type thing is the plan.
I don't know if anyone can hear us, but we're packing our stuff away now because we're getting ready to go and visit that event. So Joe, listen, thanks very much for taking the time to speak to
us. Not a problem at all, John. It's always a pleasure.